I am almost nervous to ask you about...
Please don't be nervous to ask anything. One of the things that I do this for is I think nothing should not be spoken about.
Hello and welcome back to the Life and Death Podcast with me, Stephen Rumford, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice. This podcast is all about having honest conversations about life, death and everything in between. I have worked in palliative care for over 25 years, and in this series I sit down with guests to explore their experience of death, dying and grief. Because the more we talk about it, the more we can understand it. In this episode, I'm joined by illustrator, animator, and author Gary Andrews. Gary's world changed overnight when his wife, Joy, died suddenly from sepsis. Left navigating grief while raising their two children, he turned to something he'd always done, doodling. What started as a personal outlet soon became a way to process his loss, capturing both the heartbreak and the humour of life after bereavement. His sketches struck a chord with audiences, and he later published Finding Joy, a book that brings together his daily doodles with reflections on grief, love, and parenting after loss. In this episode, we'll talk about how creativity helped him through the hardest moments, the unexpected ways grief shows up, and what he's learned about love, loss, and moving forward. All of that coming up on this episode of the Life and Death Podcast. So, Gary, welcome to the Life and Death Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for agreeing to it, I must say. I'm always amazed, actually, just how generous guests are. I mean, you said in the bit before we started recording that you've done, well, you'd lost count, I think was what you said about this. And it's just such a generous act. So,
well, the thing is, when you've been through something like this and you realise just how important talking is, it's the least you can do is talk about it and hope that it just helps some other people.
That is still a very generous act. So we're very grateful. I wonder if we could start, Gary, by whether you'd say a little bit about Joy. Who, tell us about Joy.
Who was Joy? Well, I mean, she was great. She was... She was very tall, she was very beautiful, she was very funny, she was very talented, she was a brilliant mum, she was my best friend. We made each other laugh more than anybody else could ever make each other laugh. We would get all misty-eyed about each other all the time. I was the luckiest guy in the world. And, we had a great life doing what we both loved doing, drawing, acting, making films, having two beautiful children. Yeah, it was really, it was living the dream, as it were. Mm.
How long were you together? What was your sort of...
All together, we were together for 19 years.
Okay.
So yeah, we had 19 years together, which was amazing. And that's more than a lot of people get. And so I always consider myself really lucky. Mm. One of the things that I keep going back to after she died was, instead of actually going, poor me, what have I lost? I was like, lucky me, what did I have? And I think that's an attitude that's important to remember, that you may have lost someone, but my goodness, if you loved someone that much, how lucky are you?
Yeah, indeed.
So that was something that was always a comfort.
I was going to say Star Trek struck lovers, but that isn't quite the case. It sort of reminds me a little bit of a book. I don't know if you ever read it, by a guy called Richard Bach. It's called Bridge Across Forever.
No, I don't know that.
Very romantic book. Very romantic book about finding your soulmate.
Yeah, really. I mean, it was kind of romantic. She was a brilliant actress and very tall, and I cast her as Helena in A Midsummer Night's Dream that I was directing, and we became best friends, and it that was it, and we just literally were best mates, and we used to hang out a lot and watch films and talk, and I always used to sit there next to her thinking, oh gosh, some guy's gonna be so lucky someday, you know. No, some old fart like me doesn't stand a chance, but she, you know, some guy's gonna be super lucky. And then one day we turned to each other to say something, and it was like we both got hit by lightning at the same moment, and we literally fell in love at the same moment. And it was one of the most extraordinary feelings. And it was like, oh, wow, did that just happen? Mm. And we realised it did. And from that moment, we were barely apart.
Oh.
So, yeah, so it was, you know, Star Trek, Starstruck Lovers is actually pretty accurate.
I mean, this is going to feel like something of a kind of jolt, really, but I suppose just moving the tail on. So Joy was well and healthy.
Yeah.
And didn't have any medical issues particularly.
Was never ill. One of those really annoyingly healthy people.
Okay. You know, so what was the, if you don't mind revisiting,
I know
you've done this a lot, so I...
Yeah.
But what was the sort of...
The timeline? Yeah.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, we'd been away for a weekend. We'd been down to Glastonbury to a fairy festival, like you do, selling a film that we'd made, like you do. And we'd taken the kids, you know, and had a great time and, you know, eating curries in the pub, listening to folk music and visiting the Cheddar Gorge on the way home and all that sort of thing. And that was on the Monday. That's right. We were driving back and I had to go straight to Heathrow. She dropped me at the airport because I was off to Vancouver to do some work for like a week. And so she dropped me at the airport on the Monday and off I went. And then on the Tuesday, I phoned to see how she was. And she was like, oh, I've got a bit of flu. I went, oh, that's a pain. You know, put your feet up. She said, yeah, I'm sat on the sofa with a dog on my lap. Okay, that's fine. You know, and then the Wednesday, I phoned again and said, how's it going? He said, oh, I still feel a bit rough. I went, oh, God, you know, typical. Every time I go away, you know, that's when, you know, one of us feels a bit poorly or whatever. Mm. And then on the Thursday, I was out at lunch with the clients having a bit of lunch. And I got a phone call from her sister saying, listen, she's been taken into hospital. Can you get a flight home? And I was like, oh, okay. Spoke to my producers and stuff that we arranged for me to come home about 4 days early from the trip, jumped on the red eye, flew overnight, got picked up at Heathrow by her mum and her eldest brother, who told me that she died that night. It was kind of like that quick, basically. So I had an hour between getting picked up and getting home to get my head together because they'd managed to keep it from the kids so that I could tell the children.
Oh, my God.
Because they knew that I'd want to do that, obviously.
Obviously, but and going back to the phone call from Joy's sister saying, you know, can you get back? Were there intimations about the seriousness of that
admission? She said it sounds quite serious. It sounds like, you know, and I was thinking, oh, is she going to have to be in hospital for a couple of weeks or something? Am I going to have to look after the kids, whatever, you know? But there was a little something in the back of my head. The tone of her voice was something where I went, this isn't good, you know? And, you know, on that flight, you know, every scenario played out in my head. What could it be? What could it be? And I played them all out. I hope, you know, didn't really think seriously for a moment it would be the worst case scenario. But of course it was. But I guess, you know, I'd slightly prepared myself for it by playing, you know, having 8 hours to think about it on a plane. Yeah. So it was surreal is the word that often springs to mind when people ask what it was like. Just that moment of literally suddenly your whole life being turned upside down in a moment. You know, everything before that moment was one thing and everything after that moment was something else. It was quite an extraordinary feeling. I mean, I'd lost both my parents by the time I was 30, so I was used to bereavement.
Mm.
And I think in a weird way that helped because although it's a very, very different type of bereavement, you expect to lose a parent. You know, it's part of the natural order of life. It doesn't make it any better, but, you know, you expect that. I lost them earlier than a lot of people do, which was, you know, by the time I was 30, they were both gone. But I still, it was still the right way round.
Mm.
And the practical side of grief I'd experienced, and I'm an only child, so I'd had to deal with it all and all that sort of thing. So certain elements of the bereavement process were familiar and therefore copable with. But there's this whole other level on top of it by losing someone you've chosen to have in your life, your partner, your soulmate, that you say, and having children to deal with as well, which is something I'd never had before, you know, in previous bereavement situations. So obviously there was a whole load of new stuff coming in. But I think having been prepared for some of the other side of it was kind of useful in a lot in a strange way. Mm. You know, elements of the grief process were familiar. And I knew what box to put them in.
Right. I do. Yeah. It wasn't complete sort of terror incognito, was it?
Yeah. I wasn't floored by it completely because it was like, okay, I've got things to do here. I know I've got to do that and I've got to do that. I can do that tomorrow. That and I know that feeling's going to hit me in about a week. Mm. And it was all this kind of stuff that was there in the back of my head while dealing with the practical of, you know, the kids.
And I mean, that's, I am almost nervous to to ask you
please
about...
Please don't be nervous to ask anything. One of the things that I do this for is I think nothing should not be spoken about.
It's as much about... Some of it is about, you know, we've just met and I don't want to, you know, just like coming with both my big boots, you know, stomping.
Assume that I've heard everything and that nothing can offend or upset me.
Fine. And I do. What I was going to confess to is my own sort of caution about talking about having that conversation with your children. You know, if I imagine that reverse for me, that's a conversation that, you know, one can think about.
Well, but... I can tell you now, it's the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life.
Okay.
But by the same token, it also, my instincts as to how to do it kind of kicked in and kind of informed everything going forward for me, really. I mean, they were 7 and 10 at the time. And I took them out into the garden and we sat in the garden and I said, okay, listen, there's something you need to know. You know, mummy was really poorly and got taken into hospital, you know, and they're like, yeah. And I said, well, the doctors have done everything they could for her, but I'm afraid there was nothing they could do and mummy died last night, you know. And I literally used those words. Mm. And they looked at me. So this is the only thing that I ever talk about that gets me emotional when I talk about it. It's the one thing that sort of still makes my eyes prickle when I think about it. But they said she died. I went, yeah. So they'd used the word, I'd used the word. There were no euphemisms. And I thought that was really important. And then, they both made sounds I never want to hear them make again, you know. And that went on for about 20 minutes. And then the extraordinary thing of then after that, when the sobbing stopped, you know, they turned to me and said, what's for tea? You know, and you go, yeah. What's for tea is kind of the thing I've got to remember now. You know, I live for these two guys now. And, you know, this is the thing. Their life, my life, life around is continuing. And I had to sort of go, yeah, okay, should we have a takeaway? And, you know, and it sort of went from there, really. And so the two really important things were realizing that nothing else had to stop, that normality had to be continued in some way, shape or form, despite the rug being pulled out from under them in such a horrendous way. And also using the right words, not using, oh, you know, gone to sleep, we passed away, but saying she's died. You've got to get that worst word out of the way, because then from that moment, it can get better. The worst thing has just happened. You know, and that was my sort of gut feeling. And that's kind of what I took forward with me for the, you know, on the journey as we went on.
Mm-hmm. So obviously the journey does, like you say, it does carry on, you know, life is king. And what were those early weeks like for you? I mean, obviously you've had your previous experience of the death of your mum and dad. And that I think does give you, it does give you some insights into the sort of emotional, psychic world you enter, where your inner landscape is, you know, the twin towers of your internal world are disappeared.
Yes.
And
yes,
so yes, your kind of mapping, your mapping of your interiority has changed, doesn't it?
Well, you're living by the moment, you're making it up as you go along. You know, there are a million books about grief and about, but there's no one way of doing it. And there is, you know, there's no right or wrong. And I just went with my instincts and it was very, very strange. I mean, it was important. I said to the kids, look, I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to get stuff wrong. I'm going to look after you guys now. This is my job. I'm going to look after you. I'm going to get some stuff wrong. I'm going to annoy you sometimes. You're going to annoy me. We're all going to make mistakes. I'm going to cry. You're going to cry. Don't ever be afraid to cry in front of me, because I'm going to cry in front of you. And, you know, let's not forget her. Let's talk about her every day. And we, you know, nearly 8 years, well, 7.5 years on, she still gets talked about every day. it was kind of, we just had an open dialogue with these little people and it was extraordinary. And then my friends were amazing. One of the most incredible things that my friends did, which I heartily recommend to anybody who knows anybody who is bereaved, is they set up a WhatsApp group amongst themselves that I wasn't allowed to be on. I wasn't allowed to be on it as an admin sort of thing. Whereas they basically, I had a couple of admins on the group that I could contact, but they had a separate group. It was called the Andrews Support System, ASS. and basically, if ever I said, I need a babysitter, or can someone go to shops and get something because I'm tied up, they would put it on the group chat and someone would go, yep, I can do that.
Mm.
And this incredible network of support was possibly one of the most amazing things that came out of it. They weren't afraid to step up and do it. You know, when someone dies and, you know, you're someone's friend, you go, oh, is there anything I can do? Let me know. But then as a person, you feel, oh, can I call you and actually let you know I need something? Because you kind of feel you're imposing or whatever. Or someone says it, but they don't actually mean it. Or they say it and they can't do it because they're busy or whatever. But when there's 30 of them on a group or whatever it is, someone will be there. And it was just the most brilliant thing that they set up. And I would, you know, that's a recommendation to anybody listening to this who knows somebody who becomes bereaved. Set up a little group for them.
Yeah.
It's so good.
You're known, as it were, because of the work that you produced and then distributed primarily over social media. I mean, I'm a total dinosaur. I'm not on anything. So I don't know anything. But apparently there is such a thing as social media. And
yes, it's this weird thing out there. Yeah.
Amazing. And obviously your world is a world of creativity. Mm. You're an illustrator, an animator, a filmmaker, a theatre maker by the sounds of things. You know, your world is a creative world by the sounds of things.
Yeah.
So you've always drawn or doodled or sketched or whatever.
I've drawn ever since I could hold a pencil,
Exactly.
And it's my job. I mean, it's what I do. I draw for a living.
So just going back to the, because I described them as doodles in the intro.
Yeah, that's
when
what
I look
call
at
them.
So they are doodles, but like, so I doodle when I'm bored in meetings, i.e. all meetings. They're what I would think of as doodles, shapes and you know, sketching and shade and, but yours are more figurative and
like I said, illustrative. I mean I call them doodles because primarily there's no pre-drawing, there's no rubbing out, there's no colouring in at the end. They are just a drawn process that just happens. It's not a finished illustration that's all been finished up cleanly. It's not been considered before I start it. So in that sense, they're a doodle. So I call them my doodle, and I called it Doodle a Day.
Okay.
And I was doing one every day, like a sort of visual diary, basically. And that's what I was doing in the run-up, because I just did it literally as a drawing exercise and as a bit of fun. And it became part of my daily pattern, yeah.
I just wonder, given that obviously it's a podcast and people can look at these things, those who are more technically savvy than I could look at them. So they're not, as I say, they are figurative.
Mm.
Could you just describe a couple of...
Well, I figure a lot in them, a sort of cartoon version of myself. And it's like a third person is looking into my life from the outside. And they're a snapshot of a moment of my day, usually. Either a particular moment or a particular feeling. And if it's a feeling, I find a way to anthropomorphize the emotion. We'll come on to that possibly in a bit. But usually it's something I've seen, something I've heard, something I've done. Nothing's ever made up. It's all things that are real. That was part of my self-imposed sort of brief for myself. Never more than 15 minutes, no pre-drawings. It's got to be real. All that kind of stuff. Last thing at night. And it's now part of my daily process. They're on brown paper with black pen, with a little bit of white pencil highlight. Yeah, drawings of moments of time of an ordinary life. Just things that amuse me, things that move me. Just little beats that I don't want to forget as well. That was the other thing when I first started doing them. It was like, you know, we take hundreds of photos, don't we, in our lives these days. We've got cameras on our phones, we're Serenia, we've got thousands of photos on a thing. You know, we've got albums, blah, blah, blah. But there are moments that fly by that you can't get a picture of, a feeling. You can't get a picture of a feeling or a moment where someone says something. Oh, that's gone. You can't take a photo of what somebody says. So I wanted to have these little snapshots of things I didn't want to forget. And I mean, I'm now on sketchbook 24, just about to finish tonight, the 24th book. And it's now, what, coming up to 9 years worth of daily drawings. Of stuff that's happened every day. And I can look back through there and find this journey. It's a diary. It's a visual diary. But it's a diary of those things that I haven't got photos of, but I wanted to remember. And as I say, I've been doing it for about a year and a half, and it was just a sort of daily scribbly practice drawing. Is that my finished drawing style is a lot more finished and slick or whatever, but that's why I call them doodles.
I see.
But then when she died, you know, obviously by then it was part of my daily, I couldn't go to bed unless I'd done a drawing, you know. But obviously the thing I'd felt or seen or heard that day was very obviously to do with what had happened. And that kind of took over for a while on there. But I discovered in the doing of it that it was like self-counseling. It was like if something was happening that had worried me, I would put it down on paper and it would sort of exorcise that demon a little bit. You know, I didn't bottle up an emotion. I put it on paper and then I could sleep. So it became very much that. And that's what people started to notice on the social media. And that's when the following went nuts, you know. And then that's when it got noticed by the papers and then by the telly and then by the publishers. And it just went, you know, insane. And through all that, I made a very conscious choice to sort of never play to the audience, to keep it real, to not change how I approach it, you know, because that became important. So once people were responding to the everyday, the reality, the banality of what I was drawing, if I started to change that, it wouldn't be the same thing. So I've endeavoured certainly over the years to sort of keep it that way.
The kind of Lars von Trier's of the doodle world.
I'll take that.
Yeah,
I'll
go
take
on.
That. Yeah, yeah,
good,
yeah, yeah.
Good, good, good. There was this sort of moment of self-reflection, this kind of third person event where you could see that emotion, that event, that feeling reflected back. And then you published them. So then there was an interaction then with the public. And you've alluded to, well, not alluded, you've said, of course, that I tried not to be swayed by that. And I understand that. But I wonder when it became apparent that you're, to the degree that this had an element of self-help, I'm going to use that as a terrible phrase.
Yeah, that's fine.
I might even renege on that.
But no, you know it's what fine. That's the heading it's put under in the bookshops, yeah.
Okay, well, fine. Yeah. So something of that anyway, some sort of self-healing thing goes on.
Yeah, I call it self-counselling. Yeah.
Thank you, self-counselling. But then you must have noticed that actually this was having the other people were responding.
Exactly.
With equally genuine emotion, with equally valid, real, my God, this is so right on the money for me right now. Yeah, you've always like known me. What was that like for you?
That was extraordinary. And that was the thing that made me realize the value of what I was doing. That, you know, as an artist, sometimes you feel a little bit of a kind of, you know, a fraud. Oh my God, this is my living and I'm having way too much fun. You know, this doesn't feel like a proper job and I'm just doing stupid drawings, you know. But then when I started doing these drawings about that and people would get in touch with me and say, you've expressed on paper what I've been trying to tell my friends and didn't know how to do, and I can now show them this drawing and they know how I feel. Or thank you for letting me realise I'm not alone. Or you're 6 months down the line from me. Thank you for letting me see there's hope ahead. And all this sort of thing. I'd get all these kind of messages. And I was like, oh, blimey. This has actually got value. I also realised I had a voice that I'm very lucky. I can draw. Because I work in media, in animation, illustration, theatre, I know how to communicate. I'm a storyteller. And I was able to articulate, both visually and with words, feelings. And so many people said to me, we don't get men saying this sort of stuff very often. We don't hear that demographic speaking about this sort of thing, blah, blah, blah. And it almost became, how could I not? You know? And realising it was helping people also made Joy's death less pointless, because it felt like such a pointless thing. How could someone like that be taken away like she was? It was ridiculous, you know. But suddenly, from beyond the grave, the fact of her death was helping people. And you know, sepsis awareness was the other thing I was doing through this. So I was raising sepsis awareness. And people have said to me, if we hadn't seen your drawings, read your posts, we wouldn't have recognized it in my dad or whatever and got him to hospital in time. You know, you've saved, you know, I know for a fact, you know, people have told me we've saved lives just from posting pictures. And you go, this is a responsibility now that I need to take seriously. And how can I not?
So I might have got this totally wrong. And it's something, and I'm going to be a bit more pushy than I normally am.
Please be as pushy
because
as you like.
Because you're such a professional at this. Like, listening to this, I could have the sense, because you've done so much of the work, so much of the task of grieving and being public with it, I could get the sense that you've always been sorted about this. And I wonder what phases your grief. You've mentioned about being sad, and I don't want to, I mean, to cry on, I don't want any of that. What am I trying to get at? I'm not even totally sure what I'm trying to kind of get to. Where What I want to get to is something about where your the journey, your grief as a lived thing, and then connected with your work in terms of your doodles.
Let me see if I can help you out. I think I know where you're going with it. I think there's two sides. There's the visual, the public side that's talking about it side, and then there's the private, personal side where I go through that journey. And the journey is a roller coaster, and you go up and you go down, and there are good days and there are bad days. And even now, 7.5 years on, there'll still be a day when I suddenly look up and go, she's not coming through that door again, even now. Mm-hmm. And you can go, oh, and there's a feeling. And I think it's personified best by in the doodles. I talked earlier on about how I anthropomorphize emotions. And there's a character, if you like, that sometimes crops up in them called, I call the grief demon, who is a typical sort of winged, beastie, horned demon character, the sort of thing you'd see in Buffy or some horror movie. You know, this is sort of weird, skinny, bald, sharp horned, clawed demon with bat wings, right? And I drew him as the grief demon. And the first time he cropped up, he was clinging on my back with his hand shoved right into my chest. And every now and then he will crop up over the years where he is now in relation to my life. You know, he moved off my back and would stand a pace behind me with his hand on my shoulder. He would be sitting next to me on the sofa, and then he'd be on the other end of the sofa. Then he'd be in the corner of the room. And kind of at the moment he's in the house somewhere, and occasionally he puts his head round the door and I'll go, nope, not today. Thank you. Go away. And then sometimes I might go, are you there? Why don't you come in for a bit? And he'll come in and sit next to me, and I'll let the feelings come through again. I go, right, you can go now. But he's not going to go far. He's still around. So the relationship has continued with him, but it's kind of evolved, it's matured, it's grown. And there's a kind of mutual understanding between me and my grief. Does that make some sort of sense?
Perfectly. I was going to say that illustrates it perfectly, which is kind of corny and wrong for me to say that, but it does. No, I think that's what I was getting at. Like, it's and obviously that, in a way, just in that you describing it, actually, I've got an image in my some kind of Bosch like figure of lurks around you.
Yeah.
But to have objectified it in that way or personified it in that way, I can really see how that gives you a relationship.
Well, it gave me a control
That bit of you and control, but like it does, it's a very powerful thing that I might have to go on someone else's social media account and try and find the ones with the grief demon, because that really does. I can see then how that the art itself, the work itself.
Yeah, it was a combination. It was like the first time I thought of him that way and drew him that way, it suddenly clarified it for me what it was, and then I could see it that way the whole time. And so the feelings fed the art, and then the art fed the feelings, and now I can't differentiate it. It's like chicken and egg. I don't know anymore, you know. But whenever I think about the emotion, I always picture him and where he is in relation to me, sort of, you know, geographically. And it's
and that's such a powerful thing, isn't it, to be able to put them in a physical relation, a spatial relationship with
it
you.
It is. It's something I call, I call it this. I'm sure it's been called this a million times before, but I call it positive grieving. I sort of talked to my kids and my friends about it. And I call it, like, I'm acknowledging the grief is there, but I want to take control of it myself. So I call it positive grieving, that I find the good that I had in my life, but I also acknowledge what's happened. And I try to keep control of it myself and not let it overwhelm. And that's not to bury it, it's giving it the freedom, but also not letting it take over.
It take over ever?
Oh god, I mean, you'd be sitting there, the kids have gone to bed, and I'd be sitting on the sofa, and suddenly I'd be a snotty dribbling mess,
right?
And at those times was the time I'd sometimes pick up the phone, go onto the Instagram live, and just start saying, I'm having a rough night, folks, because I knew I had people following, you know, whatever. And I say, I'm having a rough time. I'm fine. I just need to say something. I've got nobody here to talk to, so I'm just going to say this out loud. And then what would happen was people who were on their phones would suddenly start respond, you know, typing in, we're here, we're listening, you do what you... And that community, that very real virtual community, was another important part of you know, seeing me through. Because quite often, you know, I said about, needing to talk. And that's why people go to counselling, for goodness sake, you know. But sometimes I'll be sitting there at 1 a.m. and go, I need to say this out loud. And I can talk to the cat, or I can talk to my phone. So I'll talk to my phone, and someone, you know, because quite a few people were following in America or whatever, they'd be awake, they'd be up, and you'd have a little chat with somebody, and then, you know, half an hour later, you feel better because you've unburdened a bit, and you say, thank you very much, you've really helped me, and they say, not at all, glad to be of service, and then you go to bed. And so, yeah, there were times that it did feel overwhelming. But again, I didn't let it overwhelm me and push me into some black pit where there was nobody there. I always tried to let it out in some way, you know, ease the pressure.
Is it, I mean, we've talked about the demon, and the demon seems to be becoming more of a kind of occasional visitor into your physical space. So I presume that's answered the question in that grief in its obvious form of a source of pain or suffering or sadness or those kind of range of feelings is lessening. I'm trying to get at something about the shape of your life without joy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, that moves into another area, if you like, which I can come onto as well. But I'll give you one more analogy with the grief analogy, which another one I've used for people as well, is if you think of your life as a sort of computer program or a computer, you know, and when someone first dies and the grief comes in, it's all over the screen. It's what is playing. It's using up all your bandwidth. It's there. At the moment, it's a subroutine running in the background. I don't even notice most of the time. But it's still there in the background, ticking away very quietly. And when all the other things are switched off, you go, oh, that's still going. What's that little spinning wheel in the corner? Oh, it's the grief. It's still there. So it's kind of like that as well. You know, I mean, the other things have taken over. The balance has changed, but it's continuous. So that gives you another analogy. In terms of the shape of the life now, I mean, my life took a big turn about 4 years ago when I fell in love again. And that was completely unexpected and out of the blue. I wasn't looking. And you know, I met somebody and, you know, we fell in love. And that was like, oh, that happened. And for a moment, I went, oh, what happens now? This is strange. Am I cheating on joy? Do you know what I mean? It's weird. And then the analogy I play on that one is I talk to people about how when Lily was born and all this love that you feel for your child and you go, wow, this is amazing. And then Joy got pregnant again. And I was like, oh, how does that work? So when this baby comes along, have I got to give half that love to that one? This is weird. How's that going to work? I don't get how I'm going to love a second child as much as I love my first one. And then he popped out and suddenly like another door opened and all this other love came out. And I was like, oh, I get it. And that's what happened when I fell in love again. None of the love for Joy went away, but this other door opened up and all this other love came out. And suddenly you're going, okay, this is possible. I understand it. Made more possible by the fact that Lisa, my now wife, we've remarried, it speaks about Joy almost on a daily basis as well, includes her as part of our dialogue, talks to my kids about her. So she's never been pushed away and sidelined as part of the dynamic. So I think because Joy is included so much in it, the pain of the grief isn't there because she's still part of our extended, you know, blended family, includes her.
You know, what you say is that essentially love, without getting to it, love is infinite. You know, love is only bounded by imagination and opportunity, I suspect. You know,
well, exactly. The corny cliche, isn't it, is grief is love with nowhere to go, sort of thing. People say that, you know, and you wouldn't grieve if you didn't love the person. And so love is the most important, you know, without wanting to get all hippy-trippy and whatever. Hallmark Cardi about it. You know, love is the most important thing in life, yeah. Sure, you know, surely.
It literally is an answer to everything.
Yeah,
really. I mean, you know, I'll join you on Hippie Trippy, even with my bald head. I would join you with it because I think it is the answer. And what you just alluded to in that moment of, you know, when you meet your child for the first time, it's like, oh my God, I didn't know I had these.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought I knew what love was. I thought I loved my wife. I thought I loved my mum and dad. I loved my friend. Oh, there's this whole other range.
A little bit different type. There's a different sort.
Absolutely different.
And they've all the loves have got their own personality, their own way of being. And that carries through with the love for the person that's died, the love for the new person in your life. And those two loves can exist side by side. They're not mutually exclusive.
Brilliant. Gary, that has been a pleasure.
Oh, bless you.
I feel like I've been on a journey. You know, I do, honestly. No, honestly, I do. You know, it's very, very clear. Well, another wonderful episode, really, of the podcast, I think, there with Gary. I think one reflection I have from the podcast is about the doodling containing this image of grief as a kind of sort of slightly comic, demonic figure that he puts closer or further away to his character in these images. I liked it in the podcast, and on reflection, I really, really like it. I think it's such a smart way to go about integrating that emotion, that reality into his life. And it shows how effective he's being at integrating it at different times. The image is either very close to him, or it's sat sort of skulking in the corner of the room. He seems like a very wise and generous-hearted man. So I'm very grateful for him being on the podcast. If anything we've talked about in this episode has resonated with you, or if you're looking for support around grief and bereavement, you can find helpful resources on our website at ashgatehospice.org.uk. And if you've enjoyed this episode, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you think and help us keep the conversation going. This episode was produced by Olivia Swift, and it's a Reform Radio production. I've been your host, Stephen. Thank you, and we'll see you again next time.